baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the walk-off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard Podcast for the casual fan.
And another one. My goodness.
Hey, this is Arden Zwelling, and for the third time, you're hearing me say that you are listening to the Walk Off Podcast.
Very excited to have back on the show Sportsnet analyst and Blue Jays insider Arden Zwelling. Welcome back to the Walk Off, man. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. What's going on, guys?
So I'm going to start with this because I am very curious. Obviously, it has been a trying few weeks for Blue Jays fans and Blue Jays players and the organization in general. What's it like covering this Blue Jays team when everywhere you turn, somebody is screaming, "The sky is falling"?
It's a great question. You know, when you're like in the bubble, I guess, or kind of in the pressure cooker of it, you don't necessarily think about it. Like you're just on to the next thing, like when it's your job, right? So like, especially that stretch of 30 and 31 to start the season, and for a number of sort of scheduling reasons, I ended up working almost all of them. You're just like on to the next one, right? And you're just on the next one, on the next one, on the next one. And you don't really actually take time to kind of step back and breathe and, you know, smell the roses a little bit. So you really are just like on to the next task of what you have to do work wise. And then in those like rare sort of gaps in between, you know, work stuff, you're like just trying to get your life in order. So honestly, like I feel like you don't feel it as much maybe as fans do.
So you're not gripping it as hard as some of the players are, obviously.
I'm not as emotionally invested as players and fans are in the results. No, I'm really not. Because I got to do my job either way, right? If they win by a million, if they win by two, if they lose by a million, if they lose by two, I still got to do the same job.
Does it get tiresome constantly being like, okay, time to talk about the lack of offense again?
What's funny is, so what, they've played like 44 games to this point, maybe 45, somewhere in that range. I feel
43,
like
yes.
43? They're
23 and 20.
So if they've played 43, I feel like they've played the exact same game like 38 times. And maybe there are five that were different. But those 38 were all the exact same, right? It was a one or two run game, and they were like 1 for 10 with runners in scoring position, and the starting pitcher was pretty good, and the bullpen was maybe good, maybe not. Like it does Groundhog Day is a good way of putting it, right? Like it felt like for a while they were just playing the same game over and over and over again. So you definitely get that sense for sure of like, wow, I've seen this before. Like it was nice to have that offensive outburst on Tuesday night, just because, look, that was May 24th. And for 23 days in May, I'd said, they're going to break out of it. They're going to come out of it. The offense is going to come out of it. Look at the hard hit stuff, right? Look at the expected stats. They're going to come out of this. And 23 times I was wrong. So it was nice to have that one time,
right?
Number 24, when I got to be right. So I'm 1 for 24 this month, which is good. I'll take it.
Even that 8 runs yesterday, I was just like, I was looking back through all the games. That's the most runs they'd scored since the first game of the season.
Yeah.
Like, who would have bet?
They still haven't had 10 or more since that day, right? So that's pretty surprising. Like, how wrong were all of us about this offense, right? Coming into the year, the one thing you said about the Blue Jays, it was like, geez, we don't know what Kevin Gausman's really going to be, like new week, new team. Like, we don't really know what this bullpen's going to be. Like, we don't know about the rotation. The one thing we know is they're going to hit. Of course they're going to hit. Well, no, they didn't, right? And it is this, like, hilariously torturous thing where for the last several years of Blue Jays baseball, it's been like, man, they can't get a rotation together and they can't find dependable starting pitching. Well, you got that now. And for the last several years, it's been like, oh man, they boot the ball around and they can't really defend. Well, they're pretty good defensively now.
Yeah.
And for the last several years, it's been, look, if they can do one thing, they can hit. They can't not hit. And now all of a sudden they get the rotation and the defense sorted out, and all of a sudden they can't hit. Like, it is so uniquely torturous the way this is played out.
That is such a great way of putting it, is uniquely torturous.
Well, even in that 8-run outburst, they go 2 for 14 with runners scoring position.
Yeah.
Right? Like they still, right? Isn't it? What an insane game. And everybody in that game has a hit except for Santiago Espinal, which is the complete opposite for the first 42 games of the year. So like baseball is like such a maddening sport to watch, to cover. I can't imagine what it's like to play it every day.
Yeah. Or bet on. My goodness.
Well, yeah, I can't recommend that.
Yeah. And I mean, the three of us have watched enough baseball throughout our life that we're aware that this is what happens whenever the going gets tough. The fire the manager crowd starts to rear their heads. And honestly, Arden, what's funny is I think we had this exact same conversation last year around this time when the bullpen was the heart and soul of all of the woes when it came to Blue Jays fans. Curious how you're feeling about old Charlie Montoyo as the manager here. And even more than that, is Charlie's job secure? Because obviously we're at a point where, and I mean, we did see the offense break out a little yesterday, but we're at a point where it feels like maybe a shakeup just for shakeup reasons is something that needs to happen. Do you think realistically there's any way that it comes in the form of a manager change?
I don't see it. I don't think there's any reason to question Charlie Montoyo's job security. I don't think they should make a managerial change. I don't think that they will make a managerial change. Like what have you seen from this front office to suggest that they would do something so reactionary?
It does feel like a panic move, doesn't it? And that's very uncharacteristic.
But this is just not the way this organization makes decisions. No. It's just not the way that they act. You know, like it's one bad month or it's 23 bad days. Like they're not going to start firing people over it. Like that would be completely out of character for this front office. Like this is a very rational and methodical and process driven organization. So they really don't do things based on whims and emotions, you know, like they do reassess their coaching staff regularly. They do it every offseason. Like we've seen it the last several offseason, changes have been made to the coaching staff based off of the way things played out the year prior, based off of the exit interviews they run at the end of the year and the surveys and the endless meetings and like all the corporate stuff, the strategy sessions, all the stuff that they do to sort of make decisions, all that process. They assess how the coaching staff operated the year prior, where it was successful, where it was inefficient, how it could be better. And then they make adjustments, right? So we saw Hunter Mentz added to the coaching staff this year. Like they haven't been taking away hitting coaches. They've been adding hitting coaches. Hunter Mentz comes in to focus on swing mechanics. And, you know, Dave Hudgens gets shifted from bench coach to like a more hitting focused and offensive focused role where he's helping players get prepared and he's focusing more on skills and mindsets. Then John Schneider, who had last season taken on more of sort of the in-game management stuff, gets elevated to bench coach. So his role changes. Like the Blue Jays do make these changes. Gil Kim comes out of the front office into, you know, he's in uniform on the bench with the club every day. This is a front office guy. And he's working on like daily scheduling and practice design. So like this front office, like they do make a lot of changes to the coaching staff and they just don't do it on a whim because results aren't going their way for 3 to 4 weeks. Like that's really not their MO.
I know Adam and I were even talking about it a couple weeks ago that we were impressed with how the fan base kind of kept in check and wasn't screaming for Charlie's head. And that has kind of gone out the window here.
But so what is that based on? Like that's based off what you're seeing on Twitter?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is it's a great place to really gather information is Twitter. Yeah.
It's not really a representative sample of the fan base, right? Like what percentage of the Blue Jays fan base do you think is active on Twitter, right? It's probably a single 1%, digit percentage point.
Right? Yeah.
1 or 2%. So you're not hearing from like 95%+ of the fan base. So I don't think that we have like a legitimate way of taking the pulse or the temperature of the fan base. Like we don't actually know, like this, they don't distribute the surveys. They don't do market research on these things, right? They don't call people up, like ask them to press buttons, correspond, you know, how would you rate your level of satisfaction with Charlie Montoyo's job? Press 1 through 9. Like they don't do that type of stuff. So I don't think we actually know how the fan base feels. I think we know how a dozen people,
the
on
most
Twitter
vocal
feel.
Twitter folks feel. That's a very good point. We did talk coaching a little bit. Guillermo Martinez, same sort of question. I'm guessing that his job security might not be quite as good as Charlie's at this
Why?
Point.
Why do you feel that?
I don't know. I honestly, my gut reaction is that I feel like the Jays are at a point where something has to be done, and maybe that's just the fandom in me, you know, like just where I'm feeling it more, you know.
Like, but like all those things I just said about Charlie, wouldn't they also apply to Guillermo?
It would of course apply to Guillermo. Yeah.
Like it's not a front office that does something just for the sake of doing something, right? Like they always have a reason to. And like even just the thought that there's one coach who's solely responsible for the performance of 12 hitters, like that's like saying that, you know, like Pete Walker is the only reason why like Robbie Ray and Kevin Gausman and Yusei Kikuchi have happened. It's not just Pete Walker, he's part of it, but he's like the tip of the spear, right? There are so many other people who work on that and who go into it. So it's like there is no just one individual who is responsible for the performance of the collective.
By the way, too, when I say moving on from Guillermo Martinez, in my thought process, I don't think there's a light switch solution to any of this. And I don't think that getting rid of any one guy would solve the problem instantly. It was more of a, would this shake up the clubhouse enough to get something out of it? It would be all psychological. I don't even know if that would work, but it was more...
Does that work in your workplace? I know guys aren't
really workplaces,
but comedians. It's not about getting rid of a guy. It's about bringing a guy in named Juan Soto.
Juan Soto is going to be your hitting coach?
Yeah.
Or to Yuan Dax. I'd rather he hit.
No. That's the rumor right now going around is that Juan Soto's on the trading block. I mean, Toronto's been thrown out there. I don't even think he's going to leave Washington, but...
I would be surprised if the Blue Jays trade for Juan Soto. I'd be very surprised. I don't even know what a return.
I'd be surprised if anyone trades for Juan Soto. Like, is this even a legit rumor? Do you think the Nationals could literally be thinking of moving on from a generational talent like that?
I think it's more of like a fun thing to discuss in the industry, right? Of like, what could a possible return from Juan Soto look like? Because how do you even return value on like a 23-year-old?
He's one of those
top three hitter.
Slow news week. I got to put out an article today, kind of a thing.
I'm not saying that. Like, I think it's just like an interesting discussion to have. Like, I think it's just like, you know, like that's what people in baseball always do. They just like create these like interesting scenarios and try to problem solve their way out of them. Right. So it's like, how could you potentially return value on Juan Soto? You know, like, I don't know. Like, if I'm Washington, like the guy's 23, like, it's not like we're not talking about, you know, 29, 30, he's 23. Like, he's just at the beginning of something. So if I'm Washington, like I am making sure he's a Washington National forever or for as long as possible, and then I'm building a winner around him because he's probably going to be good for like the next 10 years at least. So I've got a bunch of shots at it with one of the best players in the game. So that's what I would do if I were them. But like I don't get fire Guillermo Martinez. Like, I don't know how that would actually tangibly change anything for these hitters. Like, I don't, because like there's still, it's not like Blue Jays hitters like suffer from a lack of resources or from a lack of people to talk to. And it's not like Guillermo Martinez is the only guy talking to them about hitters. Like I said, if they want to talk about mechanics and little tweaks that they want to make there, Hunter Mentz is right there for them to talk to. If they want to talk about, you know, mentality and mindset at the plate, they could talk to Dave Hudgens. They got Jimmy Von Ostrand who can help them with, you know, that's the mental performance coach. And he talks to them about controlling emotions in the box and like keeping their minds clear, or, you know, if you're not like generating enough like torque or enough power with your lower half, go talk to Scott Weber, who's like the head of strength and conditioning, and he can help you like maybe activate a bit more with your lower half. So it's just not, you know, they've got guys who can dive into the numbers with them and the analytics and the metrics and the data. Like, I just think it's a much more collaborative approach, you know, coaching hitters and providing the resources that they need to be successful and to perform at the big league level. So I don't think there's any one individual who is like, it's your fault that they can't hit with runners in scoring position. Like, I just think that's kind of antiquated thinking. It's not the way the game works anymore.
So I'm curious then, if you were in the front office, philosophically, when do you think a shakeup is something that would work, whether it is a firing of a coach or maybe a trade or something? And is that even something that in the sport of baseball could work?
So a trade I'm looking at like right now, and right, I like okay. most front offices are dealing with the draft right now, really, because that's right around the corner. Mm-hmm. And the Blue Jays have a bunch of picks in the top, I think they have five in the top 100 or something like that, because they've, you know, they got a couple comp picks for Robbie Ray and Marcus Semien. So there's a lot of work going into that from the front office perspective, a lot of time and resources. But I'm absolutely looking around baseball, and like I'm absolutely like calling the Royals and just like, hey, what do you thinking about doing with Andrew Benintendi, right? Like mm-hmm. I'm calling, you know, my old pal Ben Sherrington with the Pirates and saying, hey, you know, Brian Reynolds is a pretty interesting yeah. guy, you know, hey, what are you gonna do with Ben Gamel, you know, like absolutely I'm having those discussions. I was just watching the Reds on the weekend and saw Tyler Naquin, who's having a decent year, and I was mm-hmm. like, you know, he might be an interesting fit, and there's actually history there with him from Cleveland days. So I'm absolutely making those calls and having those discussions when I have free time, when I'm not diving into the amateur scouting reports with, you know, the players who are going to be in the draft, and thinking about, wow, you know, how do we value like drafting a catcher these days when automated balls and strikes are going to be coming in, you know, in future years? Like, do we really value the framing and some of the defensive stuff? But, you know, I'm not a big change for the sake of change guy. I think to me, like, I think the Blue Jays actually have a pretty good process for how they determine whether or not their coaching staff is working and whether they mm-hmm. want to make any adjustments and any changes to it. You know, the other thing people never bring up when they say fire this person, fire that person, is like who they're replacing him with.
Yeah.
Like who's if you're just replacing like internally, if you're just elevating John Schneider into the manager seat, like John Schneider's already there. Like he's already yeah. helping make these decisions.
Right? He's part of the problem if that's the case, right?
Like, So what, you're gonna fire all of them? You're gonna fire all 12 or whatever. Like I don't like there's never a replacement. And then well, okay, oh, so you do have a replacement. So you have somebody who's not like familiar at all with any of these players, who's not familiar with this front office, who doesn't know the systems and the processes, who doesn't know all the media obligations and all the stuff that like managers do throughout a day and hitting coaches do throughout a day that we don't see on TV for 3 hours every night. You're gonna throw them into that with the pressure of needing to like win and fix this thing right away. I just don't know if that's really a spot you want to throw just somebody random with no familiarity into. So I just, yeah, I'm just not a big fire the coach guy, as you can probably tell.
Go ahead.
Can I jump? I just want to jump in here because you mentioned getting ready for the draft, and we had a conversation on Sunday about a pitcher out of Tennessee right now, Ben Joyce. I'm not sure. Yeah, so you're familiar with him. Obviously, yeah. I mean, a guy throws 105 on the radar gun. Yeah. He literally puts himself on the radar, right? So he's, I think, projected around 80, 90 right now in the draft. And obviously the Jays have a couple extra draft picks in like the 60s from their compensatory picks with Semien and Ray leaving. Any chance the Jays would take a reach on a guy like that? And if they did, let's just say they do. Do they just suit him up day one? Do they draft him and get him fitted for a Jays jersey the next day? Or like how
is 105 MLB ready, Yarden?
Like I think still need some development time. No, so that's 105 will play.
That's the second question, right? Is whoever does take a guy like Ben Joyce, how much time gets wasted in the minor leagues? Like he's 21 right now. What else can we work on before suiting him out there in the
MLB? Well, you have to ask, you know, questions of MLB readiness, right? Because like it's one thing to throw 105 in the bullpen before scouts, one thing to do it on a college mound, it's another to do it in front of like 40,000 people under the lights on MLB on national television. Everybody's watching. You're gonna end up on Twitter if you know screw up and walk the world, and all your friends and family and everyone from home is watching and sending you messages, and oh my god, the pressure. So like you have to like assess a guy's readiness. So that would come from a lot of background interviews and like cross-checking and talking to people around him. Hey, what's this kid's makeup like, his mentality, what are his routines like, you know, like what type of dude is he? And so you would get an assessment like that, and then you would obviously sit down with him and talk to him and make your own assessments on him. And if you really believed that he could step straight from the draft into MLB, which is very rare but not unheard of, Garrett Crochet did it with the White Sox 2 years ago, was it now? When I think it was the pandemic year, I think it was 2020, drafted in the first round, bang, right into the bullpen. I could see it with Ben Joyce. Like, man, 105 don't grow on trees, you know? So, if, yeah, like if you believe he can throw it for a strike and he can handle the stress of MLB and he can perform on that level, I don't see why not. And I think it's a really interesting thought and consideration for the Blue Jays, who need swing and miss in their bullpen, who need that velocity in their bullpen, who have, like, it would make some sense if you believe that he could do it. But then there's also, like, the trade-off of, okay, where are we selecting him? Because he's like, I don't know if he's getting to the third round, man. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if he's getting to those compensatory picks, like a guy who throws 105. Like,
mm-hmm. A lot of teams willing to gamble, right?
So are you going to burn your first round draft pick, the amount of pool that would come with that? So Blue Jays selecting around 20 or something like that. So we're talking like $3, $4 million of pool at slot for him. Like, are you going to burn that? Are you going to burn the opportunity of drafting a kid who's like 18, 19 and who you can get into your developmental system and build into maybe a starter someday, maybe an outfielder, you know, maybe a starting shortstop someday, right? Like, there's an opportunity cost there as well. So you're like, you're weighing all mm-hmm. those things when you're making that decision. But yeah, it's a fascinating one for sure.
Arden, do you remember the final scene in Major League when Ricky Vaughn comes out of the bullpen and he throws 97 miles an hour and then 99 and then it shows 101 as he strikes out and they all win, go to the pennant or whatever?
Is that what you're foreseeing? That's what's going to
happen. Well, no, I'm just saying, like, 101 back in 1990 when I first watched that movie was just like...
Unhuman.
What? 101? That's so fake. There's no way. And now here we are being like, 105 would play, you know? Like,
Blue Jays see 101 every night.
Every night? Like, yeah. It's wild.
Right? They went through Cincy and they saw it regularly. And then they saw it just with Hicks in St. Louis. They're going to see Ohtani. In LA, the Blue Jays have seen the highest like average fastball velocity of any team in baseball. Yeah. It's like every night, somebody in the upper 90s. Average MLB fastball is like 94 miles an hour this year, which, you know, 10, 20 years ago, not that many guys threw that hard. So, yeah, it's the way the game's going, man.
Yeah,
and,
velo, yeah, man. It's
where
crazy.
We are.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move to pitching. Being we're talking that, and I mean, despite the offensive struggles this team has had, I mean, the pitching has been unreal. It's why this team is 23-20 after 43 games. Like, it's why this team's head is still above water. The starting
the
pitching
Blue
has
have
been
a rotation.
Yeah,
sure. Right?
It was a while there where they didn't have a rotation. It's a few seasons as
wild.
You may remember.
Yeah,
it was like, you know, an opener, and it's like Buddy Beauchesne is opening for Ryan Fairbend or something, right? Like, it's
Wilmer Font's coming out to start the game.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so there's
no sophomore slump for Alec Manoa this year.
No, the Blue Jays used six starters this year, right?
Like, that is such a good point. That is such a good point. That the Blue Jays, you look at it and you're like, they actually have a starting rotation. I actually can say the five pitchers that we're going to see 5 days a week, and they have been particularly impressive, that starting rotation. Do you expect to see this continue? Obviously, there's ebbs and flows to a season and ups and downs. Is this who this starting staff is, in your opinion?
There's the only guy that you can look at and be like, is it sustainable? I guess, as you say, Kikuchi, just because we have seen such ebbs and flows from him, right? Mm-hmm. And because there is always the Yusei Kikuchi of old, who could come back around. However, I did think it was encouraging. Kikuchi's last time out, everything's going off the rails in the first inning, right? You want to like walk, single, walk, hit a dude, not getting calls, missing by a mile. And like when things are spiraling and going that way and Ross Stripling's warming up over your shoulder in the bullpen, and you've only gotten out, and you see Pete Walker in the dugout stressing out and all this stuff, like, when that's happening, it'd be so easy to fall back into old habits and be like, oh, you know, I still have that cutter that I really like. You know, let's just go back to that. Let's go back to the guy I was. But you see Kikuchi stuck with the plan and stuck with the new, like, pitcher that the Blue Jays have morphed him into. And I thought that was super encouraging, right? Yeah. That he stayed with the fastball and he stayed with the harder slider and he, like, kept working on the things the Blue Jays want him working on. So to me, that made me think it is sustainable. If this guy faced that level of adversity and didn't revert to the old guy, that was encouraging to me. So yeah, I think it's all, with health, sustainable, right? Have you seen any reason to think like Kevin Gausman's stuff isn't going to work anymore. Like, the splitter is one of the best pitches in the game. Alec Manoa clearly is as aggressive as anybody in that rotation, and like gets himself into jams and just leans on his fastball and trusts his fastball in the zone. And it's only like 93, 94, 95. He can get 96 if he wants sometimes, but typically be around 93, 94. But he's got a four seamer that goes one way, a two seamer that goes another, and he's confident in it. He has an attack mindset that's sustainable. Jose Berríos has been one of the most dependable starters in baseball for several years now. And who am I forgetting? Hyun-Jin Ryu. I mean, he's your five, and you just want two trips through and him to be able to locate his curveball and throw it 89 to 90. So I think it's sustainable what they're doing with health, which none of us can predict.
So you bring up Yusei Kikuchi. I do want to just start what I'm about to ask you here with the caveat of I'm well aware that Pete Walker can't fix every pitcher. He can't. But my goodness, it sure seems like this Blue Jays front office has done a really good job of, over the last couple of years, of identifying and targeting guys that he felt he could help, right? And left-handed guys with some velo, maybe lack some control. We saw it with Steven Matz. We watched it happen with Robbie Ray. Now Yusei Kikuchi seems to be on the right path. Is Pete Walker this good, Arden?
It's, yes, but he is the tip of the spear, right? Like, there's a lot of people that go into that. Like, Pete Walker's an elite pitching coach in MLB, and like, he is very adept at like, managing down and up, I guess would be the way to put it. Like, he can speak front office language, and he can speak like analytics language and metrics and data, but he can also speak a pitcher's language as well, and he can distill all of that information down onto a level in the trenches, like the way like baseball is discussed in a bullpen, right? And the way during side sessions and out there on the mound when Pete has to be the guy who goes out and delivers a message when things aren't going well. So Pete's just really good at kind of being that conduit, but obviously there's a lot more that goes into it, right? Because there's, you know, scouts and analysts who like identify in pitchers that the Blue Jays believe they can help, and they look for guys with certain traits, and they look for guys with underutilized weapons or parts of the zone that they aren't attacking they should be more, and, you know, tweaks that they believe they can make, mechanical adjustments that they believe can be made. So there are tons of scouts and analysts and researchers who work on that stuff, and then you've got your front office folks, your assistant GMs and your GM, who then have to like figure out like, okay, how do we get a good value on this guy? Like, if he's a free agent, how do we convince him to come here, and how do we get his name on a contract and a deal that's going to make sense for us and that isn't going to hamstring us financially going forward? Or if it's a trade, like, what can we do to pry this guy away from another organization? That was the Steve Matz route, right? Like, is there a cost that makes sense for us that, you know, we're not giving up too much, where, you know, we're keeping the franchise in a good position? And then, yeah, it's Pete Walker and Matt Bushman and, you know, like on the ground working with that individual. So there's just like so much that goes into it. It's not like, it's just not 1980 anymore, where it's like one guy and like one guy responsible for the whole pitching staff. One guy responsible for all 12 hitters, and it's Guillermo Martinez. Like, there are just so many more people that go into it. It's really a collaborative effort.
That's such a good point about his communication skills being such an asset, right? Because, like, just to be able to take all that, those resources, but then to be able to get them across in a consumable way for the players, right? Like, I always think of Neil deGrasse Tyson, right? That famous astrophysicist who's on YouTube and the podcasts and all the shows, right? And like, I'm sure there are lots of people smarter than him, but he just has such a good way of like explaining outer space and physics and stuff to like the lay person like me. And I don't know. I think that there's like a real quality that is overlooked at times, being able to communicate, as I myself struggle through explaining that sentence.
So. Yeah, tell me about it. No, me too. but all that data and all that information isn't really worth much if you can't relate it to the player. Yeah, and if the player doesn't understand it, it doesn't make sense to them, and if they don't believe in it, right? It's like, why are the Blue Jays shifting so much this year, and why is their positioning so extreme this year? It's because the players are buying in, and it's because guys like Louis Rivera and Mark Budzinski and Gil Kim are explaining it to them in like relatable ways, and are showing them why it's going to work, and they have buy-in. They buy in from pitchers. That's what people don't talk about with like shifts and positioning. is like you need buy-in from pitchers, because as soon as a pitcher sees a hit go against them, against a shift, it's, well, why the hell were we positioned that way? Yeah. Like, I could have had that. I got my ground ball, and I ended up giving up a base hit because of it. What the hell? That's going on my records. So you need buy-in from pitchers to be able to position this much. So that's where, like, that's where coaching comes into play, is being able to distill all that information and make it digestible, because like baseball does not lack for information and data these days. You can put a number on anything. They are tracking everything in this game right now. But you really need to focus on what's important to you and what's gonna help you, and you know, also not what's not gonna like cloud your head. So it's like, here's 15 numbers that tell me why I suck, and you're gonna carry that to the plate. You're screwed, right?
Yeah,
you need to focus.
You save
on
that
ones
for arbitration. No.
Exactly. That's a good point.
Baseball in general has become more collaborative. I'm guessing the big reason for this, and I mean, we've seen it within the Rays organization and Cleveland before Shapiro even came this way, and the Jays are very collaborative. That a lot of that is to insulate from people leaving, I'm guessing. Right, like if Pete Walker were to get a job offer and go elsewhere, do you think the Jays are insulated enough that they would still be fine on that standpoint?
Yeah, I think that, you know, they, the Blue Jays would feel confident like in whoever they're replacing him with. Like that, you know, Pete would, like, I think he's got a really good gig with a really good organization right now. So I don't know that he would leave to take a pitching coach job somewhere else. It would be for a managerial job, right? I don't think the Blue Jays would block that move. Typically, like if you're moving up, like if you're getting a promotion, this organization doesn't really block you. I mean, if it's lateral, there might be a different conversation. But yeah, I
unless it's your dream job with Boston, right? Then we're like, sure. No.
Yeah. Who came back in that? Wasn't there a trade there?
Yeah. Who was it? Was it a Vila or somebody? It was somebody that wound up getting moved again, I think. I forget who it was now.
You know, look it up. John Farrell trade. But yeah, there
John
was
John Farrell trade, yeah.
Right? Yeah, Toronto Blue Jays trade manager John Farrell. When do you even see like a headline?
That's
like
so
this?
Weird.
It is so strange. Yeah, David Carpenter. Toronto acquired Mike Avilas and David Carpenter. Or something like
times.
That. I don't know. Anyway. Yeah. I forgot your question. Sorry. I got distracted.
I don't think I even had a question. That kind of went off on a, yeah.
We're just hanging out here. It's good.
Yeah. Okay. Josh Donaldson. Curious what you think of that whole incident.
Right.
Is the one game suspension enough? And this is also, and you don't need to answer this part of the question if you don't want to, but this is a listener question on top of that. I figured we'd shoehorn it in there. But Derek in Panama wants to know if you know or not if Donaldson was well-liked by his teammates during his tenure in Toronto and what his relationship was with the Toronto media. So kind of a large Josh Donaldson question there for you.
I think there's one teammate who definitely did not like him. He's
yes.
Closing games, the Chicago White Sox right now. I feel very confident in saying that. Like I think as is, I don't think there's any player that is like universally beloved in any clubhouse, but yeah, Josh Donaldson could be polarizing for sure. And I think Josh Donaldson is a great player on your team when you're winning. And I think he's a rough guy to have around when you're losing. So like the Josh Donaldson was on the Blue Jays when they were winning and he was on the Blue Jays when they were losing. So you kind of saw both sides of that. Like as it comes to, you know, just with the Tim Anderson thing, like Josh Donaldson said something really stupid that he really like should not have said, and I'm a huge Tim Anderson fan. I love watching that guy play. Like he is so entertaining and so good for the game, both on and off the field. I love his personality. I love his style of play. He's like sneaky MVP candidate this year.
Yeah,
look at the
he's
numbers.
Been great.
He's put up. Yeah, he's been phenomenal for a team that's really needed him to be too, right? He's gone through some serious injury issues. Josh Donaldson like said something really dumb, and I think that like he should just serve his suspension and own it and apologize. Because if anything, his suspension looks a little light to me, just
it
my
does,
opinion.
Yeah.
And I know that he's appealing it right now, and he's on the COVID IL as well, so there's like a few things at play here, but stupid thing to say, and he should serve his suspension and move on.
Especially considering if you're gonna bust the guy's balls like that, there's so many ways that you could have gone that wouldn't be construed racially, right? Like, you know,
a lot
he says
of stuff gets said at field level, right?
Yeah.
A lot of really bad, you know, and players say a lot of really bad things to each other. And it very rarely becomes like a benches clearing incident. And so that's how you know it's like something that crossed a line.
Big time.
And I don't know the full history between them. Apparently, I guess there is history between them, and Josh sees it one way and Tim sees it the other. I don't know those details. I haven't talked to either of them about it, but like, yeah, a lot of, you know, foul stuff gets said at field level, and very rarely do you kind of see the reactions and the, you know, the very rarely does it become an incident like this. So that tells you really all you need to know about like how stupid of a thing that was to say.
Can I just jump in here with a question about Tim Anderson? Obviously, great shortstop, very entertaining. Bo Bichette has been getting a lot of like heat and criticism for his errors defensively. Tim Anderson leads baseball with 9 errors. So why does Tim Anderson get the slack that Bo Bichette isn't getting? Is that just because I'm listening to Blue Jays fans complain, or is it because of the slow struggle offensively?
I mean, you're a Jays fan, right? So do you know that Tim Anderson isn't getting heat from like whatever the White Sox fan podcast is? Like he might be.
Well, we had the White Sox fan podcast on a while ago, and it didn't seem to be quite the same level of animosity. But
yeah, I have no idea what their fans would think of his play at short. Like, I think Bo has been fine at short this year. Like, so. Yeah, there's been a couple miscues, like, but like, I don't know. Find me the world's perfect shortstop, right? Like. You could have Angelton Simmons, you'll just have no offense, right? Like, you'd have John McDonald, you'll have no offense, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, obviously, like, Bo Bichette is still growing into that position at the big league level. He's still getting better. Remember, it wasn't that long ago that he was a minor leaguer, and people were saying, no way this guy's 6 is short. Like, no way. He'll be a second baseman for sure. And he, like, has, through, like, hard work and perseverance and, like, a level of confidence that is, like, mind-boggling when you actually talk to him in person, has, like, just by sheer force of nature made himself a big league shortstop. Completely playable at the position. Is he the best defensive shortstop in the game? No, absolutely not. But you look at where he came from and where he's gotten to and how he's continuing to improve at a still relatively young age. You think about it, Adley Rutschman just got called up, baseball's top prospect. You know, he hits that triple and the announcer's like, way to go, kid. What a great moment for this young man who is like so new to this game. Bo Bichette's younger than him.
I know.
We forget just because he's got 50 bombs in the big leagues. Sure. And he's been around for a while, right? We forget. But he's still very young in this game and still developing and getting better.
I think fans will just never be happy. I mean, there's plenty of people who still talk.
I think you guys spend too much time on Twitter. That's what I think.
That's probably true. I know.
That's what you got here.
Yeah. I mean, there's people who shit talk Derek Jeter, right? So, like, you can always find people who will find downfalls in whatever player, I guess.
Everybody can enjoy the game the way they want, right? Like, I enjoy what you like what you like in this game, you know? Like, if you I don't know what if you love, like, there's people who, you know, Ryan Goins got a standing ovation when he came back to Toronto, right? Ryan Goins. Joey Votto didn't get a standing ovation this weekend when he was in Toronto. Joey Votto, greatest Canadian like baseball player of his generation, a top 3 Canadian baseball player with Ferguson Jenkins and Larry Walker, best baseball player that the city of Toronto has certainly ever produced. Didn't get a standing ovation, didn't get anything. Ryan Goins got a standing ovation, right? Okay, like, fine, fair enough, man. Like, I enjoy it the way you want to enjoy it. To me, like, Joey Votto is a more meaningful player, in baseball in this market than Ryan Goins is, but like, everybody sees it their own way.
You're such a free spirit, Arden. Enjoy it how you want.
Right? Whatever. I'm not going to tell anybody how to enjoy anything. I'm going to be like, I think Joey Votto deserves a standing O, but I'm not going to tell anyone how to enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay, Matt Chapman, I just want to touch on him real quickly here before we get into listener questions, because he has been incredible defensively. I mean, he's been just a joy to watch play the hot corner. I think that his glove has done nothing but help shore up the left side of this infield. I think it's given Bo confidence. And even his offensive analytics, if you look at stuff like the peripherals, like barrel rate and hard hit rate and exit velo, you know, it's kind of showing that he should be doing better than he's doing. Do you think at the end of the season, Matt Chapman's batting line is going to be fine? You think he finds that career average? Like, do you think he's going to be at the end of this a wash and it should be fine?
So what's fine, I guess, would be the question.
Right? I guess, and no, that's a good question. I guess, in my opinion, fine would be batting average 220, on base percentage over 300, hits around 25 to 30 bombs.
Yeah, I can see that. I think okay. I can see that for sure. I don't think it's getting hard to see the 2018, 2019 guy coming back with the, you know, offensively, right? Like it's tough, right? Because you're right. He does hit the ball so damn hard, right? And he does have such a good plate approach. Like, you know, his hard hit rate, his max velo, his average exit velo, like those are all going to be within the top 5-10% of baseball. Takes a walk, gets himself into a ton of 3-1 counts, like very patient, discerning, selective. So
yeah,
there's a lot of
discipline. Yeah.
Indicators there, right? That he could be that guy again. We just haven't seen it for a while now. So maybe like that was his peak there in 18, 19. Maybe he settles into that, like the guy that you're describing, right? Who's like a 220, 230 hitter with 25, 30 bombs and, you know, 310 OBP. Like, I think you're fine with that if you're the Blue Jays. I think that mm-hmm. would produce a weighted runs created plus over 100, which you're fine with. You know, you'd love it if he could tap back into the, you know, what was really working for him in 18 and 19 prior to the like really serious hip injury that he had, which I, you know, obviously affected him last season. He's admitted to that. I don't know if it's still, you know, lingering or if that's still an issue for him now. It's not stopping him from generating power and transferring force from the ground through his bat. Guy hits the ball really, really hard. So I like, generally speaking, I will bet on things like max exit velo and swing decisions, you know, really hard contact. Those are the thing Matt Chapman does. So I'll bet on those. And Blue Jays have very much bet on them this year and next. And we'll see if he can get back to that, like, 130, 140 weighted runs created plus level that we saw earlier in his career. If they do, like, you're talking about, like, you know, top 10 MVP balloting type of deal. We'll see if he can do it.
I love that you're like, describe fine.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's
yeah. Right, right? No, it's very yeah. true. So out of curiosity then, Jordan Groshans, he's absolutely killing it right now in AAA. He's got a 450 on base percentage, a 350 batting average. His slugging percentage is down. He's not hitting for a lot of power, but it seems like nobody is other than Aaron Judge right now in baseball. Is Matt Chapman blocking Jordan Groshans, or can you see a call-up from Groshans here despite the fact that his main positions are third and short?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Bo Bichette's blocking Jordan Groshans. Mike Chapman's blocking, Santiago Espinal's blocking Jordan Groshans. Like, he's having a really good run at Buffalo. Like, full credit to him. Like you said, the power is the one thing that if you really want to poke holes at it, but you love the OBP that you're seeing from him right now. And yeah, you're just loving what he's doing with Buffalo. I just don't see regular playing time for him in the majors right now is the thing. So it's like, it's easier to kind of foresee a way to get Gabriel Moreno playing time in the majors, just with the nature of the catching position, right? And you don't have an everyday catcher anymore. Like, you're going to be cycling guys through, and with that DH spot open, which allows you to kind of get a Kirk bat in there and a Jansen bat in there on days when he's not behind the plate. But with Groshans, like, I don't think you want to bring him up to be Vinny Capra and to, agreed, like, not play, right? Mm-hmm. So if he's coming up to play, one of, like, Matt Chapman, Bo Bichette, Santiago Espinal, or I guess Vladimir Guerrero Jr., if you throw Groshans at first, I don't know that he's ever even done that before, though. One of those guys isn't going to be playing, and those guys all play every day. So it's just, there just isn't room for him right now.
So more or less, and I mean knock on all the wood, without an injury, Jordan Groshans is just going to continue to develop in AAA is probably what this organization will go with, right?
You want him playing regularly, right? Mm-hmm. So you want him continuing to develop, like you said. Like, he missed a lot of time earlier mm-hmm. in his career because of injuries, because of the COVID season. Like, he has not had a ton of games played as a professional for a guy who's been in the system for a while for a number of reasons. So I think you want him getting that experience and getting those reps and being in a groove and being ready to come up and step into a big league role if, like you said, you get like a Bo Bichette hamstring strain that's going to cost him 6 weeks, or a Matt Chapman oblique issue that's going to be 6 to 8 weeks, or something, you know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. broken bone or something like that. Like, if something like that happens, you have him as a pretty good, you know, layer of depth at AAA.
So
he is still young too. I mean, people forget he just turned 23. Like, he is still youthful, but he's been in the system for so long that it feels like he's older. But
he's 23, but he might have like 120 games. You know, he's really just has not played that much in his professional career.
So then, barring one of our infielders having a case of bad tacos, do we just see him waited out at AAA for two more years until Matt Chapman leaves?
I don't know about two more years. Let's try to get through the next 2 weeks.
right.
I don't know, man. Yeah. 2 years out. Yeah. You know, like, guys get hurt, right? Underperformance happens, you know. Like, so we'll see. We'll see what happens. I can't tell you anything about 2 years from now. Can't tell you anything 2 months from now, which is the trade deadline, right? So
describe fine. Yes.
Exactly. No, I'm not. I don't have like short-term vision, let alone that type of long-term vision. So, well, look, he's playing really well right now, which is what he needs to be doing, right? And he's putting pressure on the organization and putting them in tough spots, which is exactly what he needs to be doing. I see a much more just easy way to get Gabriel Moreno on this roster, really. And I think that is something the Blue Jays should be considering right now, is promoting Gabriel Moreno, because there's another guy who is like, well, he scuffled a little bit there, you know, towards the end of April, early May, and he's come out of it in a big right way. On. The bat is like MLB ready. You talk to anybody and the bat is ready to go. And I think that you could find playing time behind the dish for Kirk, Jansen, and Moreno. And Moreno also, you know, he could play the infield for you. If you look, Matt Chapman and Bo Bichette don't really take days off, is kind of the thing, right? But if you wanted to give Matt Chapman a day off at some point, Moreno could play third and be like that Russ Martin type. And without a permanent full-time DH, I think there's room to kind of cycle your catchers through there. And look, we just saw the Blue Jays carry three catchers for basically the first like 7 weeks of the season. Mm-hmm. And obviously that didn't produce a ton of playing time for Zach Collins. It took a Danny Jansen injury for things to open up. But I think that, you know, I could see a Blue Jays roster construction with Gabriel Moreno on it and him getting enough playing time to continue his development in the big leagues.
Sure, it's been nice to see Danny Jansen put it all together, eh? I mean, he's been so dedicated defensively since he was called up in 2018. The guy has done everything that was asked of him, and to watch him kind of put it together with the bat, I mean, it's pretty cool.
It's funny because he's doing, like, throughout the like Blue Jays offensive struggles, everyone was like, well, why don't they, you know, they're getting pitched away so much, just go the other way. Why don't hitters these days use the whole field, you know? Like, why don't they just go against the shift? Danny Jansen's like, nah, I only pull.
Yeah.
He's doing the complete opposite of what, you know, all the amateur hitting coaches would have suggested, and having tremendous success with it. He has embraced the fact that he is a dead pull hitter. And I think that, like, he is also a really like good example of how important mentality is to hitting, like how much hitting really is mental. And you talk to people who have actually stood in that batter's box, which I have not, and they'll tell you anywhere from like 60 to 90% of it is mental, depends on the guy. Mm-hmm. But I really do think that Danny, a lot of what was locking him up at the plate for the last few years was mental, and was thinking about, I got to be going the other way. I got to let this ball travel and get deep on me. I got to think about these mechanical tweaks I'm trying to make so I can spray the ball, so I don't get shifted so much, so I'm not rolling over everything. And then I think the ball is just getting on him a little fast. Right. Yeah. Because he was thinking about that. I think once he let all that go and said, it's okay for me to just be a pull hitting catcher, because like catchers don't really have to hit that much to hang out in the major leagues. Mm-hmm. If you're like minding your P's and Q's on either side of the ball, if you're a good leader, a good game caller, good receiver, if you're dependable and accountable, and like you do all those things that go into a catcher's day, like if you just pull a few home runs, like if you just Mike Zunino it, like you could have a very long good career. Yeah. And so I think he let go of a lot of those things, started doing a lot less mechanical drill work before games to try to go the other way, stopped doing like 15 things with flips and, you know, T work and stuff to try to go the other way, focused on just like 2 to 3 drills that get him ready to pull inside pitches in games. And that power is transferred now. And at the plate, I think just mentally, he has just been freed up to just like see ball, pull ball, watch it go into the seats, and be a really good catcher. So I think it's, you know, it's that's a lot of what's going on there. I think mentally, honestly, has been the biggest thing for him.
So do you think this is sustainable? I know small sample size to start the season, but dating back to September of last year, coming back off the IL.
Arden, do you think Danny's going to hit 5 home runs every 11 games?
Look, let's project 2 years down the road, okay?
Yeah, what do you think about his 2025 season?
Is he going to be fine? Yeah. He's not going to hit this many home runs at this rate. If he does, he's the best home run hitting catcher of all time, right? Yeah. So I just don't think that's sustainable. But I think absolutely, like, he can, you know, he can hit enough to like be a really good catcher in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. Like, he's back on him to the majors, right? We kind of forget about that because of the struggles he went through. He was a bat first guy when he got up to the big leagues, and it was the defensive stuff that has had to, you know, take some time to be refined and to be improved at the big league levels. So
I said,
Mike Zunino exists. Like, you can hang out in the big leagues for a long time.
Mm-hmm. I really do think you're right in the idea of, and we were lucky enough to have Danny on the show about 3 weeks ago, and he was talking about how now that he's decided he's just going to pull the ball, that it's almost like there's this, like, you know, weight off his shoulders. And you kind of summed it up, right? Is like, now that he can just concentrate on one thing and not worry about all the other stuff that every amateur hitting coach out there is telling him to do, and, you know, and the Blue Jays Twitter is screaming from the rooftops. It's been really good for him. And it's funny how you can almost, like, your brain can almost become too cluttered, right? Where you're just like, it's tough to really pick up what you should be doing if you're thinking in 8 different directions.
You mentioned everybody that Jays play throws 100 these days. Like, it is hard to hit 100 miles an hour, right? Like, it's hard to be on time for that, and to also worry about, like, the wipeout slider that righty probably has as well. Like, the Hunter Green is going to be throwing you as well, right? So you got to do that while thinking about, like, oh yeah, I got to let this ball travel and go the other way, and I got to keep my, you know, elbow tight, and all these, like, weird, you know, all these little things that I tried to, like, all this muscle memory I tried to program into myself to go the other way. Like, it's just a lot to be thinking about at the plate. So, like, I don't know if you guys talked to Danny about it. I know I have, that, like, it freed him up letting a lot of that stuff go and just, like, feeling like himself at the plate. Like, he feels like he is just so much more on time now, and, like, hitting is timing at the end of the day. You just being on time with your pitch, and Danny Jansen is right now. So yeah, no, he's not gonna hit this many home runs at this rate. It's just it's too hard at the big league level. But, like, the MLB average catcher is like an 84 weighted or runs created plus dude, right? Like, I think Danny Jansen can easily be 100, you know, if he's doing what he's doing now.
Okay, Adam, I think, so Arden, we're going to switch to listener questions here. We've got a pile of them, and if we don't switch soon, we're going to run out of time. We really appreciate how generous you are with your time with us. It means a lot. All yours, Adam.
Okay, so first one comes in from Addison. She wants to know, why are the umpires so angry, and why are they taking it out on baseball?
I don't know. Why are they so angry? I guess because there's this box on the screen now that, like, is, you know, everybody is judging them. Like, that didn't always exist, right? So now, like, the umpires are dealing with, like, every pitch that is thrown, they are being graded on in real time by everybody at home. Go read Jeff Passan's piece about it. Like, that's not how umpires are graded, right? Because, like, if umpires are graded on that box that's on TV, their percentages would be super low, and, like, the MLB would have a huge problem. But they're actually graded on a bigger box than that, and the reports that they are getting back are suggesting that they're, you know, correct 95%+ of the time, more often than not. So there's, you know, I think that umpires just face a lot more scrutiny these days. And if you had to face that level of scrutiny every night, you'd probably be, you'd be a little chapped yourself.
No, absolutely. All right. Next one comes in from Jeremy, wants to know, does baseball change the baseball mid-season to deal with this dead ball crisis we seem to be dealing with, a la the sticky stuff from last year?
They have. I mean, in the past, like, they have changed the ball. I think that's, like, pretty indisputable when you look at, like, the different, you know, outcomes that you get from very similarly hit balls, right? I think a big, like, change might be in just how they're stored in the humidor. Because I think that, like, the humidor storage is having a big impact on the balls. Like, you'll talk to guys who say, like, some of the balls feel lumpy. I remember when I first heard that, I was like, what the hell? Like, what do you mean the ball is lumpy? And I started looking into it. Like, they put them in the humidor And because of the humidity and because of the temperature, they like expand and, you know, contract, and then you take them out of the humidor and then they expand and contract or whatever. You know what I mean? Like they're like physically changing. And that's how you get these inconsistencies in them and these little like little divots in them almost. Right. So that I kind of understand it now. That's why you'll hit a, you'll hear a lot of hitters say the ball feels squishy off their bat, which again is another one that I was like, what do you mean it feels squishy? What are you talking about? But like it's because of I think just the changes in temperature and the way that is like impacting the ball. And I think they did something different with the way they wind the like we're really getting into it now, boys. The way they wind the yarn in there, they wound it less tightly so that it would, you know, not travel as far, wouldn't be as bouncy. But then of course that makes it more prone to the lumpiness and the inconsistencies, and like, oh my god, man, like I just wish we had just a consistent baseball that everyone was happy with, other than the one right now the hitters hate and pitchers hate and fans hate.
The only one who likes it is Aaron Judge.
Yeah,
Aaron Judge loves the baseball. No problems with the baseball right now. Although I don't know, maybe he'd have like 30 bombs.
Maybe he would have like 30. That's a great point.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it would be so funny to just compile all of the players describing the ball over the last 4 months. You know, like even Manoah, I got such a kick out of being like that. You know, some of them are fluffy.
Fluffy.
You know, like, squishy.
I haven't figured out what
like
the fluffy one means. Yeah. That's, you know, it's something to do with the seams. A big one I've heard lately from pitchers is just inconsistency in how much the balls are kind of like tacked up, right? How much they're rubbed up, because you're supposed to rub them up with like some dirt. And there's actually a diagram in the rub up room or whatever you want to call it, where they rub up the balls. And it's like, you, here's a picture of a ball that's not rubbed up enough. Here's one that's rubbed up enough. And here's one that's too dark. And the whoever is rubbing them up is supposed to like hit that one in the middle. I think we just need a consistent ball that like has a tacky substance on it that is agreed upon by everyone, and it's like we're not rubbing this thing up with dirt like it's, you know, 1992, like it's 2022. Like we can like create a synthetic material like that, we just something that we apply to the balls, you could spray it on there, that is tacky and that pitchers are happy with, hitters are happy with. And I'll even go a step further, and I think there should be like mandated like sticky stuff on the mound where pitchers get like, it doesn't have to be the world's strongest man like Atlas stone lifting shit, like just a mandated, you know, sticky stuff that everybody agrees upon, that's okay, the pitchers can use so they can control their stuff, because somebody's gonna get hit in the head. Like somebody's going to get hurt, man, with some of these baseballs that pitchers just cannot control. So before that happens, I think MLB should absolutely like standardize the stickiness of the ball.
This is the most baseball problem I could possibly imagine, is going into the season being like, we need to find a consistency for the balls. And then 3 months later, it being like, well, the balls are the most inconsistent they've ever been. Perfect.
I mean, they own the company that makes them. So, I mean, if you want to look at somebody, you can look at MLB. They have a direct line to the people who are manufacturing these things.
All right. Next one comes in from Frank. Frank P. asks, Arden is very openly pro-player and seems quite in tune to the owner/labor topics. So, question. If Arden was the commissioner of the MLB with ultimate power... in brackets, ignoring that the commissioner works for the team owners and MLBPA is involved.
I was going to say, like, this is a faulty premise already, because if I'm commissioner, I just do whatever the owners want me to do. That's my job. That's how I get my yachts. Right?
So ignoring like, that,
that's how you get your yachts.
Out,
I want to keep getting my yachts.
Yahtzee. All right. So how will you balance the team versus players revenue split? And how would you see old and young players' share of the pie differently?
Oh, geez. Like, I didn't prepare my CBA presentation. Just pull up the old PowerPoint here. If you actually see revenues versus expenses, I don't have an answer for that. Are you kidding me? Like, I'm not prepared for that at this point. Yeah, but if I was the commissioner, I would do exactly what the owners want me to do, which is what I think baseball's current commissioner does, because that would mean I get to keep being MLB commissioner, and that seems like a pretty cool job.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Take the heat off the owners. All right, so a couple more here. So this one comes in from the Mustard Tiger. Wants to know, how closely is Arden following the farm, and are there any unexpected surprises? And do you expect anyone to be called up soon to shake up the lineup? And if so, who would that be?
So, unexpected surprises, no. I would say two guys to keep your eye on. One of them would be Adrian Hernandez, who is a AAA now. And he's like a really interesting story. Like, he's one of these guys that Andrew Tinnish found in like on the international market at like 17 and signed for, you know, whatever. I don't know what he signed for, but like, and like, so I think he's listed at like 5'8". And I don't know that he's even that tall. Oh, he's like really small. He's not an imposing dude, but he throws a changeup that is like unhittable. That is just like Bugs Bunny, gets all kinds of funky swings. And he's not the biggest guy, so he doesn't have that much velo on his fastball. And Blue Jays have been working on with him to get some velo on the fastball, because they're like, wow, if we could get your heater up to like 93, 94, 95, you could really be special. But the changeup is like such a difference maker, and it's a big league pitch. And he has had amazing strikeout totals as he's gone up the Blue Jays system. He's in Buffalo now, and I bet you he's in the Blue Jays bullpen by the end of the year. So Adrian Hernandez is a name to keep your eye on. Another one is Yosfer Zulueta, who absolutely has velo, like complete opposite, like could hit 100 type of guy with some wipeout breaking stuff. Signed out of Cuba, and when he was signed, he needed Tommy John surgery, and the Blue Jays knew that when they signed him, and they were like, all right, yeah, we'll bring you in, like your arm looks pretty special, you're gonna get TJ, you never know how you're gonna come back from it, but we'll get you through it, and we'll rehab you, and we'll see what you are when you come out of it. He has Tommy John surgery, comes out, looks great, throwing, you know, hard as hell, great secondary stuff. Finally gets into a game at the professional level last year. I think it was with Dunedin. I want to say it was with Dunedin, whoever it was with. Literally, like, first batter he faces, he's covering first base and tears his ACL. Like, first batter of the year.
Man.
Misses the entire year with a torn ACL. So now he's back again after with a new elbow and a new knee, and is like throwing hard as hell and with great secondary stuff.
Where is he at, Arden? Do you know which affiliate he's playing with?
I think he's with Dunedin. I think.
Okay.
He might be up to Vancouver by now. I'm not sure. Like, he should be up to Vancouver because he's that good. Yeah. And he's also old. Like, he's like an advanced prospect as well. So that's another guy who, like, honestly, if all continues to go well, if he's healthy and he keeps throwing the way he is, it might be tough to keep him out of this Blue Jays bullpen towards the end of the year, just for the stuff that he has, for the velo and the off speed and like the swing and miss, because obviously that Blue Jays bullpen needs it. Hernandez and Zulueta, those are two guys that I would keep my eye on as the season goes on.
Speaking of swing and miss, you might not even know where he's at. Any word on Nate Pearson? Has he been? I know
he's definitely in Dunedin. He threw a bullpen on Monday or a side session on Monday, and he's going to have a rehab start later this week. So,
oh, excellent.
Yeah. If his side was Monday, I want to say. So like I don't know. I don't want to speculate what day his start would be, but he'll have a rehab start with Dunedin coming up here. So we'll see how many pitches he throws and how, like, because obviously the Blue Jays want to build him up, but I'm not sure exactly where he's at from a length standpoint just yet. Mm-hmm. So that'll be informative. Like, how many pitches he throws, the velo, obviously the swing and miss. He's thrown in Dunedin, so actually we'll have TrackMan data on him, because the Blue Jays played in Dunedin last year, so they outfitted that park with all the TrackMan stuff. So we'll actually have readings on all this stuff, which is kind of cool. I just realized that now. That's actually awesome, because we'll see there the velo go. And we'll see, you know, like the locate, like really, like, you know, reliable location and spin rate stuff. So we'll be able to really assess where he's at. So I think that outing will be really informative as to how long it's going to take him to kind of get back to a point where he might be contributing to the Blue Jays.
Very cool. All right, last one here comes from Tandazo. How likely does Arden think the Jays will acquire someone like a Josh Bell or a Juan Soto? If not them, and just all being right in full optimism here, I suppose. I don't know if that's the right word for it. If not them, any other possible trade candidates? And lastly, how quickly should we expect any sort of a trade? Anything happening in June or not till closer to the trade deadline?
June's always a possibility. I wouldn't say anything imminently, like late May, early June, but yeah, you could see something towards the end of June, maybe. Like, I don't know, it's hard to predict, right? you know, right now, like everybody in baseball is just thinking about the draft, really. And there's a lot with expanded playoffs, like a lot of teams are still in it, right? Like there's not as many like clear sellers, and it's always tough as a team, even if you, you know, everyone knows you're not trying to win, it's always tough as a team, like to kind of sell veteran players, good players this early in the season to send that message to your clubhouse, to your market, that we're out and we're not trying to be competitive, because that impacts ticket sales and that impacts morale in your clubhouse. And that has a lot of, you know, knock on effects, right? That's why, you know, the trade deadline usually is when you see the most activity, because clubs like to play this thing out towards the end. So Juan Soto, unlikely. Josh Bell, yeah, would be a nice fit in this lineup. Like, I think a left-handed hitting outfielder is probably what I'm like, what I'm looking for if I'm the Blue Jays. So, like I mentioned,
is Andrew Benintendi at the top of your list?
He'd be, yeah, he'd be up there. I like Brian Reynolds a lot with Pittsburgh. Like, you know, switch hitter, can play center, which is huge. Like, I think you want a guy who could play center, particularly if it's like, if it's pushing Bradley Zimmer off the roster, for sure. You want somebody who can play center, right? If it's pushing Raimel Tapia off the roster, right? I mean, that's a little different, but you know, Raimel Tapia's owed a lot more money, and you know, Bradley's, I just think the Zimmer would be the guy to go. So in this scenario, so I want somebody who can play center. So Brian Reynolds makes sense. Like Naquin is interesting. Tony Kemp would be an interesting guy. Ian Happ, if the Cubs are,
yeah,
are
Ian
selling.
Happ's an interesting, yeah.
Even like Ben Gamel in Pittsburgh is, you know, is a guy who's having a nice season. So yeah, those, you know, I'd be looking around at those types. I think bullpen arm is always, like, you're always going to be looking to add veteran relievers with big stuff. And you hope that you have some more success with it than you did with Brad Hand and Joaquin Soria. So looking at the roster right now, yeah, like left-handed hitting, obviously outfielder preferably, and relief help. Those are the two areas that I think you're really looking for.
So you're saying that there's a light at the end of this Bradley Zimmer tunnel.
Bradley Zimmer has hit the longest home run in the history of the Cleveland Guardians. Do you know that? When Bradley Zimmer gets into one, man, like he gets into one. Like he has huge power, huge tools, athlete, really fast, obviously, like absolute premium defender, like one of the
of course,
like maybe not like a Phillips, like Kiermaier type, but like just a tier below, really, really good defender. So like if you could be the organization that helps them put it together at the plate, you could have a really, really useful piece. Obviously he hasn't to this point. He's looked overmatched and the play appearances have been tough to watch sometimes, but you see it when he gets one, like he gets one, like the ball like jumps off his bat. So those guys always intrigue me, right? Because Teoscar Hernandez was that guy at one point, you know, Jose Bautista was that guy at one point, right? And also Socrates Brito was and still is that guy, right? You know, also Derek Fisher, you know, was and still is that guy, right? Yeah, so it doesn't always work out, these super toolsy dudes, but man, sometimes it does. And so I am always really intrigued to kind of watch their progressions, because like these are the type of players who do things that are like really uncommon in the game. So it's really interesting to watch.
One thing I'll say about Bradley Zimmer, I mean, I don't know what it looks like at field level, but for watching the broadcast at home, it looks like he sure gives every ounce of effort that he has. He plays the game hard, wants to be there. And I love to see that. By contrast, and maybe you can shed some light on this, is Raimel Tapia just naturally fast? Because it's hard to watch sometime. Like, it looks like he's kind of going at half
dogging
speed.
Dogging it a little.
So is he look faster when you're there live, or is that
he's plenty fast. Yeah. He might just be a kind of a casual runner. I haven't noticed that so much, but I also haven't been looking for that, to be honest with you. Like Zimmer, like absolutely. This guy busts it out of the box on
full
everything.
Yeah.
And he like, there was that two double day that he had recently, maybe it was the Cincy series. Like the second double was a single for most mere mortals. And he just like came into second hot. Like he came in so fast. It was cool to watch. With Tapia, like, yeah, I'll take a look for that. I honestly haven't looked that closely at
just
that.
Like with like an infield hit to the shortstop, it just, by the time we see him running to first, it looks like he's already slowed down and it's just a little bit casual about it. And I would just rather see someone that's like really trying to beat out those close plays, and I haven't seen it from him yet. So I thought maybe he's actually, that's just the an eyeball test, but he's actually really running hard. I don't know.
Yeah, I would have to look at the sprint speed and stuff. Yeah. It's not in front of me, but like if I'm Raimel Tapia, I'm so frustrated with my season because has like made some very real adjustments in terms of like lowering his ground ball rate, upping his fly ball, getting the launch angle up. He's hitting the ball in the air more. He's hitting the ball hard. Like he is tapping into his exit velocity and tapping into his power without sacrificing too much contact, which is not an easy thing to do, by the way. Like he's still making a lot of contact, and like he has had a lot of balls just die at warning tracks and, you know, deep outfields. Like he, like the dead ball has not helped.
Not bad timing for sure
at all. So like if I'm him, I'm so frustrated because he's clearly put a lot of work into making adjustments at the plate, and he is not.
Talk about a guy buying into the system, right?
He's like, he's made some very, very real process changes, and there's some very real indicators there. And I betcha if you look up his like actual weighted on base and his expected weighted on base, I would think that his expected is way higher than his actual. I think he's been unlucky. But yeah, it's a results-based business, obviously. But yeah, I'd be so frustrated if I were him because some of his process stuff has been, you know, exactly what you would have wanted to see from him. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all we got for listener questions. So, Scott?
No, yeah. Thank you very much, Arden. We always appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, man. It means a lot.
Happy to. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! Osborne with a drop. Cheese and crackers. Chose to pitch to him.
Thanks for listening.